The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
I saw a pale horse,
a beast.
We're told in the Book of Revelation,
this is not a human child.
Isn't an angel?
Satan!
Armageddon is almost upon us.
Order the use of nuclear weapons.
The world is a fine place and worth fighting for.
From one end of the world to the other, I will oppose you.
They're here.
Welcome to the end of the world.
Wrestling not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities. This is PID Radio.
What are the links between the Nazis, NASA, and John F. Kennedy? We'll talk about that over the course of the next hour or so. Our guest is the author of a couple of books, one new, one reasonably new, Power Quest, Book 1, America's Obsession with the Paranormal, and Book 2, The Ascendancy of Antichrist in America. It's our pleasure to welcome Doug Woodward to the Prophecy Summit at Branson. Doug?
Derek, good, it's great to be with you. Finally, live you and in person, face
That's
to
right.
face. Yeah.
The title of your presentation, Nazis,
yes.
NASA, and JFK,
right.
I'm guessing was deliberately intended to be intriguing and compelling?
Well, yes. It's certainly when you're competing with all these other great Christian authors and speakers here, you have to come up with something that's a little provocative to get pique some interest. Mm. The reality, of course, though, is that the topic actually is very much right at the heart of that title, and so it's one of about six or seven very controversial, challenging, provocative topics in the new book, and but certainly one I thought there'd be a lot of interest in here.
Sure, there's. Well, you can hardly miss a new series on the assassination of John F. Kennedy on the History Channel about once a year. You can be sure to see something new or some new theory or some such thing.
Right. Exactly.
One of the most intriguing and baffling mysteries of the of the last century.
Yes.
But the link to the Nazis, and we'll get into the other part of your book about America's obsession with the paranormal, because
sure.
I don't want to cover the, you don't want to leave that out over the next hour.
Sure.
But
sure.
Let's start with this one, because the title's so compelling.
Right.
What links existed that you found in your research between the Nazis,
right.
NASA,
yes.
and the assassination of John F. Kennedy?
Well, there's actually a lot, and so I'll try to pick out two or three of the main ones. Certainly one is just the kind of the occult gospel of Hitler. And I start the presentation that I shared here with the folks off with what I called Hitler's cosmological argument, which essentially is in essence stated by him saying that once we have more or less proven that there are extraterrestrials, that the mythology, the myth of Christianity, will be disproven. And so is the quote essentially was saying that Hitler's goal was to disprove Christianity, and he believed that extraterrestrials would disprove this notion that God created humankind and that he created us special, and you could say at least metaphorically at the center of the universe, the center of his design. And so that was really one of his major goals. And so that sort of sets the kind of ideological background, if you will, to what the Nazis may in fact have been up to and appear to have been up to from the very beginning of their movement.
Hmm. So a little background then on what the Nazis believed. Most of us, at least most of us who learn mainstream history,
right.
Understand the Nazi Party to be a political movement.
Correct.
Were they a political party, or were they actually more of an occult society?
Well, the answer is probably both. From a political standpoint, we think in terms of fascism being associated with Nazism, National Socialism, and fascism really can be defined as primarily the association, their close cooperation between large corporations and the government. And the fascist or the fascis was actually, most folks may not know, was actually a bundle of sticks.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of that bundle of sticks was one that might say was like an axe that had a blade, but it was a symbol of power. And so actually Benito Mussolini it more or less right. invented the term of fascism and was sort of Hitler's political mentor. But the notion was that it was very opposite of communism, in which the workers would more or less own the state and the source of capital and so forth. And fascism, in fact, was that the corporations working hand in hand with the state would own the means of production. And so that's why you found the communists and the Nazis so much at each other's throat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they were both forms of socialism. And ironically, at the same time, America was experimenting with sort of a democratic socialism in the form of the New Deal.
Right.
And so, in effect, you had sort of three different forms of socialism going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we begin by talking about fascism as a political reality. You can take away totalitarianism and the dictator aspect. That can be pulled apart. You can certainly take away the anti-Semitism part of what we identify with the Nazis, and you'd still be left with this notion of corporations and the state working hand in hand. And, of course, many would argue that that's really the type of government we have in America today,
mm-hmm.
with corporations, big corporations, through paid lobbyists, being so dominant in what happens in our government.
Sure.
If we flip over and talk about Nazism in terms of a spiritual ideology, then there's a whole slew of scholars and a whole slew of notions and ideas dealing with that subject of the occult and the secret ideologies of the Nazis. And so we could look at many different aspects there. There's certainly the most famous would be the Thule Society, T-H-U-L-E.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about the skis, but we're talking about the Secret Occult Society.
Mm-hmm.
And also then the Vril Society,
right.
which were channelers, and they sort of got amalgamated into the Thule Society. And then there's, of course, a whole different slew of individuals that we could talk about that were very instrumental and very influential with Hitler in the 19-teens and the 1920s. So it's really definitely a combination of both a political and a spiritual
mm-hmm.
Movement.
One of the bizarre little facts that I stumbled across in looking into some of the occult background of the Nazis is that the Vril Society was an outgrowth of a group that got together, which included the English writer Edward Bulwer Lytton,
correct.
Who is the author of the famous line, mm-hmm. "'Twas a dark and stormy night."
Correct. Yes, actually two yeah. or three. The other one was "The pen is mightier than the sword."
Okay.
That right. was a Bulwer Lyttonism.
That's a little better than the other
yeah, one. Well, yeah, well, the other, it was, that's right. And then, and of course, he was the author of The Last Days of Pompeii. And so he is a relatively, not I would not say famous, but somewhat known
mm-hmm.
Novelist. And, of course, it turns out that perhaps his most impactful work was, in fact, The Coming Race, called the Vril.
Right.
And because it believed, in effect, in this powerful race that lived beneath the surface of the earth.
Right.
And it turns out that there were many in Berlin and in Munich that decided that he wasn't talking about a new myth. He was actually talking about something real. And so you had these sort of super powerful beings that might come up from the earth. And Maria Orsic was the primary channeler medium of the Vril. And but it was sort of their belief that they could, in fact, manipulate this force field known as the Vril, which, as it just so happens, is very, very similar to George Lucas's force from Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
So you see all these sort of threads kind of tying into what was going on. And, of course, we're just barely scratching the surface.
So how did this, the beliefs then of the Vril Society, the Thule Society, how did that then manifest in the actions of the Nazis, you know, through World War II
mm-hmm.
and then beyond?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's probably certainly a number of aspects. One of those aspects would be just the anti-Semitism. You had the famous American occultist, Madame Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, who wrote The Secret Doctrine, and then ISIS Unveiled. And so she was very involved in influencing the minds of Himmler and Hitler and Glauer and Rosenberg and a number of the primary occultists. Rudolf Hess was a big occultist. Obviously, Dietrich Eckart was one of the mm-hmm. major occultists. And so, so you had these different mindsets that were influencing Nazism. And so part of Nazism was the identification of who their enemies were, and they felt their enemies were primarily the Jewish bankers, the international Jewish bankers, and they also believed that that these Jewish bankers had been instrumental in their defeat in World War I. And so they felt that they were one of their enemies. And so there was an anti-racial aspect, anti-Semitic aspect of Nazism, and so that was kind of a core tenet. So there was kind of the flip side of that was this notion of the Aryan race. And again, Heinrich Himmler was Hitler's primary responsible party for developing what was called the Ahnenerbe, mm-hmm. which was this sort of ancestral folklore institution. It was kind of like a Nazi Smithsonian Institute, but it was focused on folklore, culture, all these great myths. And, of course, one of the great myths that perhaps wasn't really a myth but might have even been true was that at one time Germany may have been occupied by very large, tall giants that might have had blonde hair and blue eyes. Mm-hmm. And in fact, some of the Roman historians chronicling the Roman expeditions and the Roman wars in Germania suggested that the Roman soldiers, these in effect 6 foot tall bronze Roman soldiers, may have been fighting against these blonde haired giants that were the Teutons. Mm-hmm. And so there was the other side then, of course, was this Aryan race concept of getting Germans back to the Nordic blonde-haired, blue-eyed super race. Mm-hmm. So that was part of it. So that combined then just, of course, with the idea of a national socialism, and it was a way of ultimately looking at a thousand-year reign, a thousand-year Reich, a new empire, and that national socialism, and empowered by the occult, would lead eventually to Germany becoming preeminent in the world.
And the goal of you know, purifying the bloodline and mm-hmm. finding this master race, what was that about?
Yeah, well, the it turns out that, as I point out in a number of my books, that Hitler was not acting in effect just creating all of these ideas on his own in Germany, but was influenced by various ideologies and personalities from around the world. We talked, obviously, about Bulwer Lytton, who was a sir in England, along with a number of other Englishmen that influenced some of these occult thinkings. But in terms of eugenics and the creating the master race, it turns out that America was perhaps 3 to 4 decades ahead of Germany. And so I talk quite a bit in this book about eugenics and how Americans, even the president of Stanford University, wrote a book on race and blood, how the Rockefellers, the Harrimans, the Morgans, the Warburgs even put monies into institutions that, in fact, were responsible for the American Eugenics Society. So by 1900, 1905, 1910, you had literally thousands of Americans that were caught up in the notion of purifying the American blood. Mm-hmm. And their hope was to eliminate the blacks, the Mexicans, mm-hmm. and the focus in America should be strictly the Nordic. In America, it was interesting that the distinctions of the racial purification was built on this notion of race. In England, it was built on class. So you had mm-hmm. the aristocrats and the upper class and the middle class, lower class. But America, it was and has always been about race. And so it ultimately led to a 1920s decision by the Supreme Court in a famous case called Buck versus Bell, in which Kerry Buck was ordered to be sterilized because it was deemed that she was feeble-minded.
Right, right.
And feeble-mindedness was never actually legally defined. And unfortunately, a person could be deemed to be feeble-minded if they just had kind of a silly smile on their face. So you could end up, yes, there you go. You could be euthanized. That's right, euthanized or sterilized. Yeah. And so it turns out that 27 states actually passed legislation in America all before World War II to, in fact, either euthanize the disabled, the mentally ill, to force sterilization. There were over 60,000 Americans sterilized.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned the Buck versus Bell case. Turns out in Mein Kampf and in Hitler's ideology, he actually quoted Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes.
Hmm.
And in the Buck versus Bell case, in which he said, three generations of imbeciles is enough. And so it turns out that America actually supplied a lot of the eugenic, the genealogical basis for the anti-Semitism and the master race to the Germans.
And we need to, you know, watch it when we start getting a little self-righteous about, you know.
Oh, yeah. In fact, it's very clear that the eugenicists, Charles Davenport, a man named Harry Laughlin. Laughlin was still being invited to Congress even after eugenics was falling out of favor with the American public. He was still being invited to speak before Congress as late as 1836 and was instrumental in influencing Congress to pass legislation to continue to limit the immigration of the Jews into America.
Hmm.
And so Americans, the American Eugenics Society was actually influential in keeping a lot of Jews out of America and keeping them in Europe, where they would eventually be, of course, put into death camps, as mm-hmm. we call them, and many of them, of course, murdered.
And we should remember that in some states here in the United States, the eugenics laws stayed on the books until the 1970s.
That's right. Yeah. And in fact, even later, some of the laws were just recently overturned. North Carolina, I think, just recently overturned one just a few years
ago. That's right.
So it's shocking. These are facts of our history that we are not taught mm-hmm. in school, you know.
Well, something else that we are taught in school mm-hmm. or absorbed through osmosis, perhaps, is that mm-hmm. The brave veterans who fought against Hitler's war machine
right.
and won victory in 1945, you know, that once that happened, mm-hmm. Once Germany surrendered, capitulated in 1945, that the Nazi Party was smashed, decimated, went away, never to be heard from or seen again.
That is
the
theory.
Except for a few wannabes, that were made fun of, say, in the Blues Brothers, that kind of thing.
Yeah, the neo-fascists, the neo-Nazis.
How much truth is there to that?
Yeah, well, of course, there's been a lot of books that have been written about the fact that the Third Reich was not the last that we would hear of the Germans, but the Fourth Reich, in fact, has been a goal of many of the neo-Nazis that have continued to be around that we've heard about, whether we're talking about the skinheads or some other
group. The boys from Brazil.
Yes, mm-hmm. and of course, the boys from Brazil. But it turns out that we know that literally thousands of Germans and Nazis were transferred into South America. And, of course, what I talk about in this book, the key essential line of this book is how the American government, whether it was the State Department and through the IMS, basically allowing immigration into America, that Americans brought literally thousands of German Nazis into America to help in NASA and our rocket science. Brought into our military and civilian intelligence agencies.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, for instance, is Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of Nazi intelligence for the Eastern Front.
Right.
His whole organization essentially was brought into the CIA, although it wasn't called that until after 1947. But Alan Dulles made a deal with Gehlen, and Gehlen came into, in effect, the American Intelligence Service until he was eventually, and he had prearranged this with Dulles, to go back into become, in effect, the West German intelligence agency in the 50s. But for many, many, many years, they were influential in the intelligence activity that was going on. And so some have theorized that, in fact, the activity was even being made up or trumped up by Gehlen as a way of increasing his budget mm-hmm. And getting more and more dollars put into the Cold War.
Sure.
And so you had that going on as well. So anyway, the idea that the Nazis outlived World War II, absolutely. And, of course, the whole story of Martin Bormann, Operation Eagle Flight, these are some of the things that I spoke about and, mm-hmm. and have written about here.
Yeah, it inspired movies like The Boys from Brazil, Notorious, and things
yes,
like that.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Then the connection to NASA through yes. Operation Paperclip, we brought over German scientists
right.
who were former SS
that's true.
Members of the SS.
Werner von Braun would be, of course, the most famous.
Right. They become involved with the United States rocket program.
Right.
What then is the link between those so-called ex-Nazis in the rocket program and John F. Kennedy?
Yeah. Well, there's several passages and several threads. One of those is that the Germans were part and parcel of the so-called military-industrial complex.
Sure.
That Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, warned us about. Oliver Stone in his movie on JFK centers in on a number of these themes and these topics. And what we might first pick up, though, is the intriguing connection between a number of the personalities associated traditionally with the assassination of Kennedy and UFOs. It turns out that there were two individuals, Kenneth Arnold, Fred Chrisman, that Fred Chrisman is associated with the Maury Island affair, which was identifying UFOs prior to Roswell, and as was Kenneth Arnold, both of these in the Northwest, the Pacific Northwest, where I live now. And these individuals, it turns out that prior to the end of the war, as part of what's called Operation Paperclip, where many of these German scientists were ushered into America to help with our rocket program, to help counterbalance the Soviet threat, many of these scientists coming into the United States were placed in Fort Bliss, for instance, out in El Paso and in New Mexico. But Clay Shaw had actually met both Werner von Braun and Walter Dornberger. And Walter Dornberger was a key executive at Bell Helicopter.
Right, okay.
And so you had Clay Shaw, who people may remember was played by Tommy Lee Jones in the movie JFK.
Flamboyant fashion.
Yes. Well, so you have Tommy, you have, in effect, Clay Shaw paving the way for von Braun and Dornberger. So he was kind of preceding Operation Paperclip and bringing some key Nazis and deal-making with Nazis who were trading secrets and secret technology for a future life in the Western Hemisphere. And so it turns out that when Jim Garrison brought his case against Clay Shaw, that one of the first persons that Clay Shaw called was Fred Chrisman, which is pretty interesting. So one of the first persons to identify UFOs just before Roswell. Another person, Guy Bannister, played by Ed Asner, we may recall, kind of the rough guy that beats up, pistol whips Jack Lemmon's character.
Retired FBI agent turned private detective.
Yes, yeah. That was also Oswald's handler.
Right.
Turns out that about 3 days after Roswell hits the papers, there's another article in Twin Falls, out of Twin Falls, Idaho, where Guy Bannister is talking about the fact that he has seen UFOs landing in Twin Falls, Idaho.
And right? He's out there investigating for the FBI.
No, it's not identified at that time.
Oh, really?
It's not to my knowledge, is identified. He may have been identified as FBI. But the main thing is just that it's just not a random event that while Roswell is happening, that he's also talking about another UFO event. Mm-hmm. And so you have what you find, which is characteristic throughout the 1950s, is this connection between the intelligence services and UFOs. And, of course, we're going to get to answer your question here in a second. 1952, one of the most significant UFO events was known as the Washington Flap. And it occurred, in fact, actually 60 years ago, this July. It occurred in Washington, D.C., in which a series of UFOs were seen. The Air Force jets were actually scrambled. Commercial pilots, as well as the Air Force pilots, talked about them, described them. They were on radar. You had, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of people seeing these over the Capitol. It led to one of the largest press conferences of its kind during the month of July and then in that same time period. And so the question comes up, well, why was the Air Force so panic-stricken about this event? Well, it turns out from the work of Joseph Farrell and some others that Nick Redfern and so forth, that it's very possible that the Air Force believed, because of some additional negotiations that had been done at the end of the war, that the UFOs were Nazi flying discs. And so they were panicked that the Nazis may, in fact, have a group of Nazis may have, in fact, actually outlived again World War II, may have set up shop in Argentina or somewhere in the Arctic or Antarctic, and that these flying discs may, in fact, have been theirs. It may have been, in effect, as Farrell calls it, and Richard Dolan calls it, a breakaway civilization that was operating outside of a actual government, or it, in fact, may have been Nazi scientists that were captured by the Soviets, and so they saw it as a threat. And so it's interesting that right after the Roswell crash, that all of these unusual exotic piece parts that were gathered up were actually taken to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. Why? To have the German scientists there examine them. Why? To determine if, in fact, this might be German technology. So there's these connections. So, yes, there's the whole line of thinking that these were extraterrestrials and that there were bodies found. Farrell has a very strong case in swastikas and psyops and flying saucers that he goes through meticulously to suggest that perhaps it's really not the case that these were extraterrestrial flying machines at all. The fact that it happens in New Mexico, just across the border from Fort Bliss and from the other German scientists that are now stationed there, you know, you just wonder, are these things just pure coincidence? And so you have, in effect, the space program that's connected to UFOs, and there's this question about whether or not there's an alternative space program that might, in fact, be responsible for these flying discs. And the theory's been put forth by a number of folks that at the end of World War II, Martin Bormann, really much right at the center of this, that they took all of the Nazi scientists and they split them into three groups. Most either went to the Soviet Union or to America, and the technology that they were working on was rocket-based science. But the group that was working on flying disc was headed up by Hans Kammler, who was also working on the Glock, the Nazi Bell. And they may have originally set up shop in Antarctica, or they may have set up shop in Argentina. And so there's the possibility that there's this third group of science, the third space program it's sometimes talked about. And so you have all these very interesting and strange activities that go on that you wonder, is in fact, were these Nazis? And was this part of the story that was going on behind the scenes? So all these things they're difficult to prove, but there are documents and there's a lot of material that in fact is very intriguing and might suggest that these things are in fact happening.
So we've got some links there between the former, and again I use that in air quotes, Nazi scientists who come into the United States to work on the space program. We've got the research that they did, links to key players who turn up in the JFK investigation.
In the JFK investigation.
Clay Shaw and Guy Bannister.
Yes.
Why then would they have wanted John F. Kennedy dead?
Well, that's a good question, and I think that the issue gets back once again to the military-industrial complex, number one. Number two, in effect, of course, Kennedy, like Eisenhower, was aware that America was on the brink of becoming very dominated by the military. And so there's just sort of one aspect of it that was the fear of the military itself. Then in terms of Kennedy's fears, then there was this issue of the CIA, the fact that Alan Dulles, who had brought Galen in and his Nazis, who had been responsible for overseeing Operation Paperclip, that it's very possible that Kennedy was not fully aware of these things until he came into office. And, of course, then there was the Bay of Pigs incident and Fidel Castro and so forth. But very much at the center of this was very likely the possibility that he was really, as he said to Dulles, hey, I want to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces. And so it moved from the attack on the intelligence services to the Bay of Pigs, to the crisis in Cuba, and eventually we pick this up from Khrushchev's son in a book that he published back in the early, I think it was 2000 or 2003, 2004, in which Khrushchev's son talks about the fact that Kennedy and Khrushchev, after the Bay of Pigs incident, after the near nuclear war that we got into, mm-hmm. that they decided that they would push towards what later became known as detente, towards a peaceful coexistence. And Kennedy proposed to Khrushchev that we jointly go to the moon together, and that we conquered the moon together as a statement of our ability to work together and to overcome the animosity between the two countries. The theory is that this third breakaway civilization, the Fourth Reich, if you will, mm-hmm. This other group of Germans, operating and financed by individuals and organizations, either corporations or wealthy individuals, financed this organization, and it was always part of Martin Bormann's plan that he wanted to split his enemies up into two camps, and he wanted them to be so preoccupied with each other and fighting one another and feuding with one another that the German Reich would have time to perfect their Wunderwaffens, their Wunderwaffe, mm-hmm. and that these this would eventually lead them to being able to create a Fourth Reich, perhaps not purely independently of these, but perhaps with synthesizing what they were doing with the West, and that, in effect, that the West could be turned more increasingly towards fascism and towards, in effect, a combination with German science. And so the idea of the German science, German businessmen, Operation Eagle Flight at Bormann, that was planned as early as 1944, before the war had ended, was to bring all of this capability, this money, into the West, and in effect sort of slowly, quietly take over the West, such that America would in fact become the Fourth Reich.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what Jim Mars titles his book, America, the Fourth Reich. And so that's the argument. And so the space program plays kind of this pivotal point as one way in which the two economies and economic theories, the Soviet Union and America, could fight one another, mm-hmm. and give time for this Third Reich to become the Fourth Reich. So it's an interesting theory, and I find there's a lot of compelling aspects to it. It's not a simple theory.
No.
And it has many, many elements to it.
Yeah, well, frankly, it leaves a lot of people's heads spinning. And
yes.
I know in the course of this discussion, we're merely scratching the surface.
Oh, totally, yes, absolutely. We're hitting just one theme. We're really not talking much about the whole issue of the CIA mind control exercises,
right.
In the 50s and so forth, the whole issue of the national security state, why might have our intelligence services come up with this notion of UFOs as an extraterrestrial solution? Is that, in effect, something that they concocted as a way of steering the American public away from theorizing that the Nazis had survived?
Mm-hmm.
Another theory, though, that looks to be very strong, and I have a couple of quotes in the book from von Braun, is that they were admitting in 1959, another Nazi that was influential, Oberth, in 1968, statements that they made where they're openly stating that we are dealing with powers beyond our Earth, powers that we don't fully know how their flying machines work, powers that we might be able to understand more about and begin to disclose soon,
mm-hmm.
but we can't talk about them much at this time. You even had General MacArthur in 1962 addressing a graduating class at West Point, talking about we live in such exciting times because the next war may not be against another terrestrial enemy, but it may be, in fact, against an extraterrestrial enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're going, now, why would he say this in 1962? What is it that the military knows, or what are they thinking about? And so it really opens the doors to all kinds of different theories. But it looks as if it's possible that, and this is what Farrell believes, is that the Nazis concocted the notion of the extraterrestrials as a way to distract the Americans from the possibility of the Nazis creating flying discs and other and super technologies.
And then there's been some pretty compelling evidence that suggests that that was what crashed at Roswell in 1947, that it was a German craft, and certainly 2 years after the war to find out that the United States government had employed Nazi ex-Nazi scientists would have been very hard for the American public
to take. Well, that's exactly right. And, of course, as we talked about the Washington flap, what if these were Nazi flying saucers?
You know?
And so the idea of – and that's why we sort of have speculated that these CIA operatives and FBI slash CIA agents, that they might have in fact been operating under a very thought-out, carefully planned a program of disinformation to keep America from being aware, the public from being aware, that we had let our mortal enemy of World War II escape. And, of course, then the question is, well, why would we do that? Well, it's an economic question. It was also a question, well, and of course, fundamentally economic in the sense of one economic theory versus another economic theory. But it's very obvious, and virtually everyone says this, that was associated with it, that we brought the Nazis into America after World War II to help us fight against the Soviets. They hated the communists. We hated the communists. Gee, isn't this a marriage of convenience?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, by so doing, we excused literally hundreds and thousands or thousands of war criminals.
Mm-hmm.
And so we talk more about the intelligence services. One of the things that we begin to get to, and I talk about in the book, is whether or not certain CIA officials actually began to utilize Germans, contractors, scientists, specifically even one notorious one known as Joseph Mengele, as a means to learn what they learned or what they knew about the programming or brainwashing of spies and so forth. And is it possible that we actually utilize them to, in fact, begin to create Manchurian candidates for us? And so that was the whole – that was one of the major discussion points in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that when the Church Committee in the 1970s, 1975, in that time frame, investigated the Central Intelligence Agency and some of the military intelligence agencies, they began to discover these things, that in fact we had utilized Nazi technology for mind control, for programming. And so we could certainly go into that subject as well, because that's another subject in
addition
to – We could
do another hour on just that topic alone.
Just on that topic. That's pretty significant.
But I want to look back now at the first book in the Power Quest series, America's Obsession with the Paranormal.
Right.
And certainly we see it on TV today, programming aimed at adults on what used to be educational channels, Discovery, the Learning Channel, the History Channel, now filled with ghost hunters and UFO hunters and so on.
Yes, but the paranormal, our fascination with the paranormal.
And, of course, a lot of programming aimed at young adults and kids deals with vampires and Nephilim and werewolves and things like that.
And certainly ghosts, superpowers as
and
well.
And superpowers and drawing them into that world through those means, books, movies, cartoons, what have you.
Right.
But this isn't a new thing in the United States, is it, our fascination with the paranormal?
No, that's correct. In fact, what I do in book one, which is called Power Quest Book One, America's Obsession with the Paranormal, is to trace the spiritual history of America. Certainly, it begins all the way back to Jamestown, to the Masons, the Rosicrucians and the Freemasons that were – they weren't necessarily called Freemasons yet, although they might have been in Scotland. But the Rosicrucians, the Templarism, if you will, that began in Jamestown. It was actually financed by Francis Bacon and a number of others when they formed the Virginia Company. So you sort of had that group. You had, obviously, the Puritans, and you had Plymouth Rock, and you had a more, we'll call it, biblical, evangelical Christian strain that came in. But you also had other strains of spirituality. You had Johannes Kepler, who was very influential in Pennsylvania. You had the Quakers, and you had a number of spiritual forces that were sort of coming into America as well there. And so, in effect, these were coming out of Europe, either influenced by Jacob Boehme, who was considered by Hegel as the father of philosophy. He talked about God as nothingness, and God as being, and God as nothingness, which is a theme that we've seen for the last 300 years in philosophy and theology. But you have a lot of European influences, but these were typically influences that you might call the free thinkers, mm-hmm. the free spirits that were not acceptable to the Catholic Church, to even the, and for instance, in Kelplius's situation, very much antagonistic, or the Lutherans were very antagonistic towards these individuals that were interested in experience, mm-hmm. experiencing God rather than just following the letter of the Scripture. And so you had, they were sort of in those days, you might have been considered the full gospel, those people that were into pietism, that was known as the pietist movement. And so the direct experience of God as a spirit, as the Holy Spirit. And so these were influential. In fact, some would say that if the Anglo-Saxons had not been dominant in America, if the Germans had been more dominant, we would have heard much more about the spirituality of Pennsylvania, the German influence, and the German belief in pietism and so forth. Remember, Wesley was influenced by the Moravians, and they were very influential in Pennsylvania as well. The Quakers were quaking from this direct spiritual experience, mm-hmm. and so you had a complete different theme there. Well, this was all in the 18th century. In the 19th century, it moved up into what we would call, well, certainly Mormonism in the 1820s, 1830s was founded in that time frame. It's known as the Burned Out District in rural New York, mm-hmm. and there were a lot of interesting early sort of spiritualists in that time frame.
Well, why? That's not. I'm sure that's not referring to massive wildfire or something.
No, like that. It was called the Burned Out District. I forget the actual reference. Mitch Horowitz wrote a book called The Occult America, but it's a particular section mm-hmm. of rural New York that originated a number of these healers. And basically bordering on magicians, mm-hmm. and it eventually moved into Andrew Jackson Davis mm-hmm. by 1840, 1850. He was influenced by Franz Anton Mesmer, the mesmerizing. Okay. And so you had Andrew Jackson Davis, and he was in effect a channeler. I talk in the book and related a story the other day about the fact that Davis actually held a open public meeting in which he channeled a book that, it's what we've learned about channeled spirits is that they're very chatty. I think Bullwinkle actually said that too, but they turn out that they're very chatty. So they write these very long books. And of course, Blavatsky, she believed that some of her book was channeled. Alice Bailey says that all of her books were channeled. Benjamin Krim. So channeling, the New Age movement, spiritualism, all sort of goes together. And but anyway, Andrew Jackson Davis was speaking and talking at this where he was publicly channeling a book. And this one individual that was a journalist that had came in to listen to this public channeling session was a guy named Edgar Allan Poe.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so Poe was fascinated by the story of what Davis was doing, and he actually developed a short story, The Case of M. Valdemar. And in the short story, he talked about a traveling mesmerist who had put one of his followers into a trance. And eventually this trance victim, mesmer victim, pleads with the mesmerist to let him go, and he finally lets him go. And when he does, his whole body just turns into putrescence, it says in Poe's story. Right? So Poe talks about this, and it turns out that a few weeks later or a few months later in London, they report this case of terrorizing mesmerism in America, and they in effect reprint the story of Poe, and they play it as if it's truth, as if it's a true story. So anyway, so you have these channelers, these mediums. We know for a fact that by the middle of the 1850s, that there were, I think one of the examples I cite was over 50 mediums in the little city of Auburn, New York.
Hmm. Wow.
and you discover by the 1880s that spiritualism was, in fact, a religion that was probably more prevalent, let's say, than Catholicism in America, that over 30% by the turn of the 19th century to the beginning of the 20th century, so around 1899, 1900, over 30% of the American population would self-identify themselves as spiritualists.
That many.
Yes. Yeah. So then you could get into the story of now, Henry Still Alcott. Spiritualism
because a lot of people saying spiritual. Yeah.
Yeah, spiritualism is crystal ball gazing.
Okay.
Talking to the dead. Necromancy. Necromancy. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Seeing the word, but couldn't put it into my tongue. Yeah. Mind over matter. There you go. Or in my case, mind under my tongue. So anyway. So yes. So you had that. Those are all elements of card reading, tarot cards. These are all spiritualists, water witching, so forth.
Okay.
These are all occult phenomena. So, but it was in the midst of all that that you did have Madame Blavatsky come about. And I can tell that story. Mm-hmm. I don't know how we are in time and where you'd like to go next.
About 15 minutes left
yeah,
here.
Yeah, so, but anyway, so we could talk a bit about Blavatsky's orientation, if you'd like, or go somewhere else.
Yeah, well, so I think looking back from our perspective here in the early 21st century, we tend to think that historically America has been a Christian nation and that somehow mm-hmm. we have fallen away from our Christian mm-hmm. roots. Mm-hmm. And when you say that, you know, a third of the nation at
yes.
this point in the mid-19th century would have identified itself as spiritualist.
By the late 19th century. Say so, yes.
Okay.
And as one author said, this was not a regional movement, this was a national movement.
Okay.
And it was very common.
So so we really have not been a predominantly Christian, predominantly, I guess, but the influence
right.
of the occult in the mm-hmm. United States is far greater than most of us realize.
Yes, that's really the point. We, you know, the to some extent, it's a soundbite to say that we either are or we aren't a Christian nation.
Yeah.
You know, the reality is if you look at our Constitution, there are certainly biblical principles that were established in the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and so forth. But we have never been a purely Christian nation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're perhaps not a purely Muslim nation, as some might suggest that President Obama is, mm-hmm. is maybe taking us down that path. But it is true to say that this nation has always held a belief in God of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Freemasons believe that to be a Freemason, you must believe in God, but it doesn't specify whether your God is God Jehovah, mm-hmm. Jesus Christ, Allah, or just the great architect of the universe.
Flying spaghetti monster.
Yeah, yeah. Whatever. Just you have to believe in a God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, so yes, America has never been a purely Christian nation, and that is, of course, one of the main points of Book 1, is that spiritualism, the occult, has always been dominant in America. It actually gave way to, it actually generated much of the Nazi occult spirituality, as we talked at the outset.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to next, because you mentioned Helena Blavatsky.
Right.
And I wanted to get to her influence and what were the consequences of her influence in the United States.
Right. Well, she most will not know, and they may know of Blavatsky, but they won't know that she actually met Colonel Henry Still Alcott, actually outside of New York City in Vermont at a ghost show.
Hmm.
They bumped into one another. Not too long afterwards, perhaps a fallen angel or a spirit appeared to Alcott, and he said, never leave her side, be with her every day. So he became kind of Blavatsky's traveling companion and guide. And so he traveled with her back to India and so forth, and she eventually he became almost considered a patron saint of Sri Lanka, or Ceylon, as it used to be known, 100 or so years ago. But it turns out that Blavatsky's book, The Secret Doctrine, became sort of the Bible of the occult in the United States, and it was an attempt, Alcott and Blavatsky were attempting to sort of reconcile spiritualism and miracles, the miracles of spiritualism. And, of course, there was a lot of fraudulent activity in that as well, as Harry Houdini found out. But to sort of reconcile the spiritualism with American individualism and with science.
Mm-hmm.
And so Buddhism was almost dead by the end of the 19th century. If it hadn't been for Blavatsky and Alcott, Buddhism might have been completely passé. They sort of revived Buddhism and injected it with this sort of American notion of individualism and individuals questing for power. That's kind of the reasons why mm-hmm. I have the title that I do
power
in my
quest,
book,
right.
A Power Quest. And so they were, in fact, using the occult to equip the individual to be able to sort of stand in with spirits and be able to control and manipulate spirits and so forth. Well, eventually, all of this influences Rudolf Gower, or Glauer, and Heinrich Himmler and Dietrich Eckart, and they influenced this fellow named Adolf Hitler. Hmm. And so Blavatsky's book becomes, along with Bulwer-Lytton, who we talked about, probably Blavatsky's book even more so, becomes the kind of the key bedside reading, literally, for Adolf Hitler. So he would study it, and this book was hugely influential in shaping his occult mindset. And so there's been many authors that have talked about how instrumental Blavatsky's theosophy was in shaping the occult ideology of the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, once again, the point I made at the outset about the fact that Nazi ideology, much of it did not originate just inside of Bavaria, just inside Germany, but it actually originated in England
mm-hmm.
or in America. And then, of course, after World War II, you have a back to Blavatsky movement by Alice Bailey, and she and her husband Foster, not Foster Brooks, but Foster Bailey. Foster Brooks, most people won't know. I'm too old. That was a comedian. but anyway, that Alice Bailey wrote many of these books, The Externalization of the Hierarchy, which really was the fundamental beginnings of the modern New Age movement. And so you see a direct linkage between the spiritualism of the 19th century, the 20th century, into the 21st century, with much of the 2012 sort of movement or mm-hmm. theory that we are on the cusp of the New Age with 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of the continuity. So, yes, the overarching idea of Book 1 is that America, in effect, was contemplated by those as early as Francis Bacon, if not earlier, the Rosicrucians, that it would become a haven for spiritualism, for the occult. And in fact, what I argue is that America's religious freedom was established primarily not to make the world safe or make America safe for Protestants and the pilgrims,
mm-hmm.
but it was to make a haven safe for those who believed in Freemasonry and the occult.
Hmm. And so that we come full circle almost
yes.
this conversation, starting with the Nazis through Blavatsky back to the Nazis.
Right.
And then now into the future.
Yes.
What do we see coming as a result of this occult history in the United
right,
States?
Right. Well, and a good. It's great to ask the question. One of the points I'd like to make is that while I talk about, and I find it compelling that the Nazi flying disc might have been, in fact, some of the things that were being seen might have been at Roswell, might have been the Washington flap, and so forth. I don't necessarily believe today that all the flying disc are in fact technological marvels that may or may not be manufactured by our own government. They may be, but I think probably many of the signs that we're seeing, in fact, are UFOs that may, in fact, be from, let's say, not extraterrestrials, but from fallen angels mm-hmm. or from spirits that are manifesting themselves.
Interdimensional.
Yes, yeah. And pretty much as L.A. Marzulli and as others have talked about. So I think that, well, it may have started one way, it may have ended up in another way. And, of course, there are many that theorize that there is an effective connection between the technology of America and the technology supplied by the fallen angels or the Nephilim. And so I don't rule that out at all either. That's very much a possibility. So, but where we are today clearly is this notion that the Nephilim are, in fact, the fallen angels are poised to come on this earth and to become very visible. They may have already been here for quite some time and even influential, if not dominant in some areas, but it may become visible. It may become disclosed. But even if we take a look at the question of, for instance, I talk about the movie Prometheus that came out that I thought was a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, its theme is really dealing with a theme that is demonic, diabolical, and ultimately is proposing that the ancestors of humanity are in fact aliens, extraterrestrials.
Mm-hmm.
So whether we're dealing with Eric Van Dyneken and Chariots of the Gods or Zachariah Sitchin and so forth and all of those teachings, we're kind of all coming around to the same notion that whether, you know, it may be that we're all agreeing that there is a teleology, a certain design, intelligent design. Unfortunately, most of the scientists that are buying into intelligent design are buying into this notion of panspermia
mm-hmm.
or intelligence out of the cosmos
yeah.
that somehow founded the ancestors of America, of Earthlings.
That's the danger for the intelligent design movement in schools, is that you might get intelligent design taught, but it may not be taught the way you want.
That's right. Yeah, it's an intelligence of a different type. It's not the intelligence of who we would call
the one true
Jehovah,
God. Yes.
The one true God. Yeah. That's correct.
Well, it's a really important topic to understand, I think, for Christians, to know where we have been so we can understand better where we are, what the situation is around us in terms of the spiritual war that we face.
Yes.
What's the takeaway, the message that you want Christians to take from Power Quest Book 1, Book 2?
Okay. Well, certainly that the enemy has been at work for hundreds of years in America. And there certainly has been also, of course, a great America is a nation that has supplied perhaps more missionaries, has done more to do positive things for the gospel than any other country, certainly that we're aware of in modern times. Perhaps not since Israel with the creation of Christianity, and so. But on the other hand, the enemy has been at work, and it's very difficult. It's very challenging because the institutions of our government have been so infested with these notions of occultism, of fascism. These things have all sort of blended together. It's far more subtle than it was in Nazi Germany, and yet it may not be any less real. And so I would just tell Christians that it's more important than ever to understand that we are in battle, we are embroiled in a spiritual battle, and that, as Elie Marzulli said a while ago, how many of you this morning when you got up put your armor on? And so it's important that we realize that we do battle not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities. Mm. And in fact, these powers and principalities have had a plan. They've been working the plan for centuries. And the only power that we have to fight against them ultimately is the power of Jesus Christ, the power of the gospel and the authority that he's given to us as believers.
Mm. Doug, where do people find the book? The books, I should say.
Well, if you were at the conference this weekend, you would get to find them here. However,
now we're speaking to those watching.
That's right. Yes. However, for those that are not at the conference with us this weekend, you can certainly find them on Amazon. And Prophecy in the News will also be selling all my books. And so certainly if you wish to support the ministry of Prophecy in the News, I would really encourage folks to acquire them through them. If they absolutely must have it right away, very, very quickly, then they could certainly go online and order it from Amazon.
All right. Doug Woodward.
Very good. Thank you so much, Derek. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Doug Woodward, the author of Power Quest Book 1, America's Obsession with the Paranormal, and Power Quest Book 2, The Ascendancy of Antichrist America. Doug, one of the presenters here at Prophecy Summit at Branson 2012. I'm Derek Gilbert.
Thanks for listening. PID Radio is a production of the PID Radio Network, a division of Gilbert House. Please visit our website at PIDradio.com, where you'll find show notes and links to connect with us on Twitter and Facebook. We wish to thank all those who help undergird and underwrite our ministry through prayers, feedback, and donations. To contact us directly, email us at radio@peeringintodarkness.com. Opening music adapted from The Alchemist's Tower by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. Closing music, New Day Coming by Steve Grace, stevegrace.com. Content, copyright Gilbert House, and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derives 3.0 Unported License. For more information, see creativecommons.org.
Gonna step up to the microphone, say it loud and clear. A better day is coming soon to get us out of here.